As much as I might like to continue talking about things that I left hanging yesterday, I'm not going to do that, because there is one final area that I want to go into before we finish here. If you have looked at the outline that was supplied for this series of presentations in the binder, you will find that there were some things that were listed in the outline that we haven't done, and there were some things that I added in that as I prepared the presentations, I changed my mind about some things. And I've even made adjustments in some cases during the 2 weeks that we have been working on these things together. So there may be some areas of gap in the outline that you have, and there may be some things that we talked about that weren't in the outline, and what can I say? That's the way it is. I want to share one last quotation with you regarding yesterday's discussion, which had to do with the origin and nature of man. I will affirm to you, in case any of you were left with any uncertainty about that, that I absolutely believe the biblical account to be accurate and correct. It is treated as literal throughout the scriptures. Jesus treats the creation account, and particularly the creation of man and woman, as literal. So does Paul. And I completely accept that as being an accurate account of the way God brought the world and mankind in particular into being. And I embrace what was said the other evening about the age of the earth. I believe that we have to look at the earth in terms of being several thousand years old, approximately 6,000 years old. And there just isn't anywhere that you can really manipulate the record in a realistic and honest way and still think that the record is reliable and true. And one of the things we've tried to do in this class is to look at things that confirm to us that indeed the record is reliable and true. And there is a lot of evidence, and I have only presented a very few things. There is a lot of evidence that affirms to us that the biblical record from beginning to end is reliable and true. The article that I shared a few pictures and a few comments and a chart from yesterday in Archaeology Magazine for July-August of 1999 had a number of quotes that caught my eye, and I'm just going to share one of those quotes with you. It's under a heading that says, "From Angel to Ape." Convincing the public and even some scientists that humans were part of the animal world was one of the most difficult achievements of the 20th century. I would have to say one of the most unfortunate achievements of the 20th century. And we're going to be seeing societal cost associated with this accomplishment for a long time to come. This is a very unfortunate choice to foist this philosophy on our society, on our culture. And the price that is yet to be paid, I don't think we can fully appreciate. When man abandons the Creator, the only direction we can go is that described by Paul in Romans chapter 1, in verses 17 and following. When we step away from faith and look to man as the be-all and end-all, assuming that man is a part of the animal kingdom, we have completely lost sight of everything that makes life worth living. And that is a tragedy for a society to go through those kind of convulsions, and our society is wrestling with those kinds of difficulties even now. But there still is an answer to all of that. And that answer is God Himself, God as revealed in God's incredible book. We're going to continue talking about that in this final session today, and then try to have a couple of minutes for a very brief review of the topics we have considered in the past 7 days, 7 lessons. Today we're going to think particularly about prophecy. What is a prophet? We're going to consider prophecy as prediction. We're going to consider what I previously mentioned and will describe a little bit more fully today, the prophetic formula. And then we're going to finish up by talking about Jesus as a prophet. Now, under prophecy, I had also intended or hoped to talk a little bit about prophecies fulfilled in the Messiah. And I decided to completely ignore that line of discussion. It's an area well worth looking at in looking at the credibility of the scriptures, but we're not going to do that today. What is a prophet? Well, I'm only going to give 3 little answers to that. There are really more answers than these 3. This is not an exhaustive answer to the question. But a prophet is a spokesperson. According to Exodus chapter 7 and verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your prophet." Now, what did that mean when God said that Aaron would be Moses' prophet? He'd be speaking for Moses. God would give Moses the message, Moses would tell Aaron, and Aaron would be the one who stood up to speak. So the prophet here is a spokesperson. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes a prophet is also a foreteller, one who makes predictions. Deuteronomy 13:1 raises the proposition, if a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you and announces to you a miraculous sign or wonder, and that sign or wonder takes place, and then that prophet tries to talk you into worshiping foreign gods, you must put them to death. But the idea in this passage is that a prophet is one who makes predictions about things to come. So a prophet is a spokesperson and a foreteller. But most of all, I think, we have prophets as servants. And this phrase occurs several times in the scriptures. Jeremiah 7:25, from the time your forefathers left Egypt until now, day after day, again and again, I sent you my servants, the prophets. Now, a prophet like Ezekiel, he certainly was a foreteller. But you look at the things that God called upon him to do, the example that God made of his life. Or you look at Hosea, and the things that God called upon him to do to make an example of his life. And he is first and foremost a servant of the one who has given him the message to deliver. A prophet is a servant of someone, a servant of the one for whom he is speaking, a servant of the one who has given him the insight or the prediction or whatever it may be. A prophet is first and foremost a servant. Let's think about the prophets as foretellers. And that's the main area that we're going to concentrate on here today, because that's the area where we can look at some kind of evidence as to whether prophecy is legitimate or not legitimate. The Bible is a book of prophecy. We begin to deal with prophecies from the third chapter of Genesis onward, where we have statements about events that are to come. And really, when we look at the connectivity of the scriptures, we see that it's a book of prophecy even in chapter 1. But especially beginning in chapter 3, we have a predictive element in the pronouncement of the curse when God is talking to the woman and what is to happen between the seed of the woman and of the serpent. We have this idea of a predictive element. Prophets as foretellers. One of the things that we look at in terms of a legitimate prophet, and by the way, I discovered years ago in another one of those term papers that I wrote as a college student that the Old Testament doesn't really use the phrase false prophet. The New Testament does. The Old Testament doesn't really use the phrase false prophet. The prophets that oppose Jeremiah are called prophets. They're not called false prophets, they're called prophets. And the prophets that were in the employment of Ahab and Jezebel, who were prophets of Baal, they are called prophets. And this is the consistent treatment of that terminology throughout the scriptures. But in order for us to consider a prophet legitimate, that is to say a servant of God, there are certain criteria that needed to be met. One of them is that what the prophet said must come true. In Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 18 through 22, a passage that is used specifically in application to Jesus Christ, but also is a general statement about what a prophet in general must be. The Lord said to Moses, what they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, so he'll be God's spokesman, and he will tell them everything I command him. If anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, must be put to death. So God says, there will be prophets who speak in my name but don't have my message, and there will be prophets who speak in the names of other gods, and those prophets must be put to death. But then there will be a prophet who speaks in my name and does have my message. In fact, there were all God's servants, the prophets, but especially Jesus Christ. He continues in verse 21, you may say to yourselves, how can we tell? How can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord? If what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has not spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously. Do not be afraid of him. So there's a criteria here for the one who is speaking. First of all, it should be in the name of the Lord. That's a criteria. But the other thing that is brought to our attention here is that it must come true. If the prophecy doesn't come true, then it didn't come from the Lord. And you shouldn't pay any attention to the prophet who makes prophecies that do not come true. Now, there is an element of this that we're going to see in a few minutes, that there may be exceptions to that rule. But the general rule is that if a prophet makes prophecies that do not come true, then he is not a prophet of the Lord, and he should be ignored. He should not be someone that the people listen to. Jeremiah 27, 16 through 22 is a similar passage. I will not turn and read it, but it talks about people who were speaking in the name of the Lord, and they were advocating and practicing things like immorality, adultery, blasphemy. And the clear message there is that God is not actually with these prophets. No, actually, that's Jeremiah 29, which is on this next list. Jeremiah 27 is the prophets who are saying everything is fine. Don't worry about it. This problem with Nebuchadnezzar is going to vanish and go away very shortly. And Jeremiah said, well, let's just wait and see if that's true. If what they say is true, then the articles of the temple will not be carried away. But when the articles of the temple are carried away, you'll know that their message was not true. That's the one in Jeremiah chapter 27. And so they were to discern between the prophet of God and the one who was only speaking his own mind or was the servant of someone besides the Lord Jehovah himself. The other aspect that is specifically emphasized about prophecy is that any prophet speaking in the name of the Lord must not deliver a message that conflicts with the pre-existing message of God. He must not lead the people into idolatry, as in Deuteronomy 13, 1 through 5. Even if the sign comes true, even if he seems to have some power, if he's telling you to worship a God other than Jehovah, then he is not a prophet of Jehovah, and he is not to be listened to. In fact, he is to be put to death. The message of a prophet must not conflict with the pre-existing revelation of God. Now, that's very important because not only is there the possibility of demonic or occultic powers having actual effect in this world, but there's always the possibility of deception, of lying wonders, of signs that are not genuine in power. There's always the possibility of being taken in by a shyster. And so it's very important to look for consistency. And then there's the passage in Jeremiah 29 that I was starting to paraphrase previously, where we're told that people who are behaving in an immoral manner, people who are violating the law in their lives, are clearly not bringing a message from God and are not to be listened to. And then in 2 Peter chapter 1, chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, Peter does use that expression about false prophets. There were false prophets among the people in those days. And he talks about the damage that they did because the people followed them, listened to their urgings, and did not discern as the Lord had said they should, in the commandments, in the law, and from the messages of his servants, the prophets. I want us to think a little bit, continuing on with the prophets as foretellers, about the fact that prophecy sometimes, well, in fact, not sometimes, but almost always, prophecy almost always was conditional. We have an example of this in the story of Jonah. Jonah chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. Now, the fact that God could make prophecies and present them as a conditional reality reflects on something that was said earlier, that God can see all the threads of possibility in all of the directions that time could flow, all the things that could take place. And so God can deliver prophecies that would come true under a set of circumstances. But if those circumstances change, the prophecies might not necessarily come true. In Jonah chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, we have the message of Jonah. What was the message of Jonah? Verses 4 and 5, rather. What was the message of Jonah that he took to Nineveh? 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. Did that happen? No. And yet there's no indication in the text that Jonah said, unless you repent. There's no suggestion of that in the story of Jonah. In fact, when we go to the fourth chapter, and Jonah is now embittered because, as it says in the last verse of Jonah chapter 3, the Lord relented. He didn't do it because of the way the people responded to the message. And so in the first two verses of chapter 4 in Jonah, what's Jonah's reaction to that? He's mad. He's very angry. He's upset that God would do this. But is he surprised? He's not surprised at all. He says, I always knew you'd do something like this. I knew you'd be like this. Because you're a God that's quick to forgive. He didn't want to bring a message of forgiveness to Nineveh, and there's no suggestion that I see anywhere in the story that says he did bring a message of repentance and forgiveness. But the people believed what he said. 40 days and the city will be overthrown, and they changed their behavior. They repented, and God was pleased, and God relented and gave them a nice long lease on life. Rather than being destroyed in the first half of the 8th century BC, they were still there until the end of the 7th century BC. So he gave them 160 years or so of additional continuance and used them in a variety of ways because of their reaction to this prophecy. But Jonah made a prophecy that did not come true. 40 days and the city will be overthrown. It didn't come true because the circumstances that compelled the prophecy changed. We have another example of that. In fact, we have many examples of this. 1 Kings chapter 22, verses 17 through 29 is the story of Ahab. Ahab, with the help of Jezebel, had arranged to take possession of the vineyard of Naboth. Naboth was put apart. He was put to death by stoning in order to bring about this result. And once that result had been obtained, the Lord sent a message to Elijah, and the message was that Ahab and his household were going to come to utter ruin. Does anyone remember Ahab's reaction to that? He was devastated, and he tore his clothes, sackcloth and ashes, the whole bit. And God's reaction to Ahab? He forgave him. He says to Elijah, since Ahab has reacted this way, I'm not going to do this in his lifetime. I'm going to put it off for a while. And so while Elijah did not deliver a conditional message, it wasn't stated as an if-then, nevertheless, the prophecy was treated as conditional because of the reaction of Ahab. Now, this is perfectly consistent with what we're told in the 18th chapter of Ezekiel about a good man and a bad man. If you have a righteous man and he has a bad son, the bad son doesn't get credit for the righteousness of his father. But if you have a bad man who changes his way of life and starts doing good, he's not held accountable for the previous badness either. That's forgiven. And he is given life for the change in his behavior, the change in his heart. And if you have a righteous man who stops doing good and starts doing evil, he doesn't get credit for what he'd done before. He is counted guilty for what he's doing now. And so God's prophecies are very often, in the majority of cases, they are conditional. There are some exceptions to that. There are some unconditional prophecies. They may have conditions that we can't perceive. Like, I don't know, for example, with regard to the end of time, if there are conditional aspects that God is weighing and balancing. I don't know exactly how God has all of that sorted out. Well, there's a lot of things I don't know exactly how God has them sorted out. But there are conditional elements in many of the prophecies that are not necessarily stated at the time when the prophecy is given. On the other hand, there are conditional prophecies where it is clearly stated. 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 38 and 39, a prophet brought a message to Jeroboam, told him that because of the sins of Solomon, the kingdom was going to be torn away, but not completely. 10 pieces of the kingdom would pass into the hands of Jeroboam. 2 pieces of the kingdom would remain in the hands of Solomon's son Rehoboam. And Jeroboam was assured that if he would keep the commands of the Lord, if he would be faithful in following God, then he would have a dynasty like that of David, that he would have a son to sit on the throne throughout the ages. Did Jeroboam keep the commandments of the Lord? No. First act of his kingship is to set up idols at Bethel and Dan. And his kingship, his dynasty, was just a flash in the pan. It didn't last very long at all. That prophecy was stated as conditional. There are terms here, Jeroboam. God looked ahead, saw the possibilities, what could happen if Jeroboam did the right thing. Jeroboam didn't do the right thing. And so something else happened. And that particular prophecy was specifically stated as being conditional. One other aspect of prophecy that I want to remind you of is the fact that prophecies are often long-term in their fulfillment. We have the prophecies of Jeremiah. Jeremiah said that there were some things going to happen right away, and we looked at an example of that the other day where a prophet was opposing Jeremiah, and Jeremiah said, before this year is over, you're going to be dead. And in the seventh month of that year, he died. But there were other prophecies that Jeremiah made, such as 70 years of captivity, that took a long time to fulfill. And in Daniel chapter 9, verses 1 through 3, Daniel says, I was studying the books, and I realized that the 70 years had been completed in the first year of Cyrus. And so I prayed to the Lord, and we have this confessional prayer of Daniel after the 70 years have been completed. And he is asking God now to carry through and do what he had promised, to bring about the deliverance of his people, to allow them to return to Jerusalem, which he did do, which he had promised to do and which he brought about. In the book of Nahum, we looked a little bit at this the other day in talking about Nineveh. Nahum makes some long-term prophecies about Nineveh. Not just that Nineveh will be destroyed, as in Nahum 2:8, but that Nineveh would be down for the count. Nineveh would not get back up. Nineveh's wound would be beyond healing, Nahum said. That was a long-term prophecy, and Nineveh became a heap of ruins and then was covered over for centuries and lost to human sight. And to this day, Nineveh is still down and will stay down. Then in Ezekiel chapter 29, we have a discussion of Egypt. Ezekiel has several things to say about Egypt, but this is the one that I find most interesting. Ezekiel chapter 29, verses 14 and 15. This one really struck me when I visited Egypt with Tom Dennis and company. Ezekiel chapter 29, beginning in verse 13, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. At the end of 40 years, I will gather the Egyptians from the nations where they were scattered. I will bring them back from captivity and return them to Upper Egypt, the land of their ancestry. There they will be a lowly kingdom. It will be the lowliest of kingdoms and will never again exalt itself above the nations. I will make it so weak that it will never again rule over the nations. And he continues on to talk about what he means by that weakness. Now, Egypt has indeed continued on. Ezekiel made this prophecy in the 6th century BC. And I think it's a fairly audacious prophecy, because Egypt has been, for 2 millennia, one of the prime movers in world history. It has been a great power continuously for some 2,000 years, nearly 2,000 years. Egypt has been a major player on the world scene. And Ezekiel says, that's really over. And it's not going to be that way anymore. And when I read about Egypt being a lowly power here, that's exactly what Egypt is today, isn't it? You go to Egypt and you are visiting a third world nation. It is not a major player on the world scene. And I believe what Ezekiel says here, it never will be. It never was after those days. Now, that doesn't mean that Egypt didn't still have a viable culture and a lot of great things going for it. There was a lot of intellectualism that centered in Egypt during the early Christian era. But Egypt never stood on its own 2 feet to threaten other nations after this. It was dominated by foreign powers. Even in the days of Cleopatra, the famous Cleopatra that was involved with Mark Antony and Caesar, Egypt was being ruled by foreigners. Cleopatra was not an Egyptian. She was of Greek extraction. They were ruled by foreign power even in those days. So what Ezekiel says about Egypt here was a long-term prophecy, both in terms of bringing it about. It took time for it to come about. He talks about 40 years here. And also in terms of the duration that he stresses here. It was a long-term prophecy. I want to remind you of the prophetic formula, which I shared with you a couple of days ago. We had an example in the book of Jeremiah where Jeremiah said this prophet would die. I just reiterated that, and that prophet, sure enough, did die. And we were reminded that it happened just like the Lord said. And that's the idea of the prophetic formula. First, we have the word. In this case, it's the story of Elisha, 2 Kings chapter 7, 1 and 2. Samaria was under siege by the Arameans. Elisha said, "Hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. About this time tomorrow, a seah of flour will sell for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." The officer on whose arm the king was leaning said to the man of God, "Look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of heavens, could this happen?" "You'll see it with your own eyes," answered Elisha, "but you will not eat any of it." Elisha makes a prophecy. This is going to change overnight, Elisha says. You'll know that it's the work of the Lord. Then we have the event, the word plus the event. 2 Kings chapter 7, verses 10 and 11. So they went. These are the lepers who'd gone outside the city to surrender to the enemy and found the enemy nowhere in sight. They went and called out to the city gatekeepers and told them, "We went into the Aramean camp, and not a man was there, not a sound of anyone, only tethered horses and donkeys and the tents left just as they were." The gatekeepers shouted the news, and it was reported within the palace. So we have the word plus the event equals the fulfillment. 2 Kings chapter 7, verses 18 through 20. It happened as the man of God had said to the king. So we're told this is the fulfillment of what the man of God said. It happened as the man of God said to the king, "About this time tomorrow, a seah of flour will sell for a shekel and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." The officer had said to the man of God, "Look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of heavens, could this happen?" The man of God had replied, "You'll see it with your own eyes, but you will not eat any of it." Doesn't that seem kind of redundant to keep telling us this over and over in these verses? But the point is, there's a kind of a formula that we're following here that says, God said it, it happened. Remember, God said it, and it happened. That is exactly what happened to him, for the people trampled him in the gateway, and he died. So the word plus the event equals the fulfillment. Now let's think about that once again. Matthew chapter 26, after the Last Supper, Jesus is talking to his disciples, verses 33 through 35. Peter replied, Jesus has just said, you will all fall away. You'll all abandon me. Peter replied, even if all fall away on account of you, I never will. I tell you the truth, Jesus answered, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. But Peter replied, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And all the other disciples said the same. There's the word. The Lord has made a prediction. Then we move into the courtyard of the high priest's house. Matthew 26, verses 69 and 70. Peter was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him. You also were with Jesus of Galilee, she said. But he denied it before them all. I don't know what you're talking about, he said. And then we move to the end of the story, verses 74 and 75. Peter began to call down curses on himself, and he swore to them, I don't know the man. Immediately, a rooster crowed. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken. Before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. The prophetic formula is still being used in the New Testament. We have numerous occasions where Jesus says something, and we'll be told in the text either how it came about, or else we'll be told in the text, the disciples didn't understand this at the time, but later, after this took place, they remembered what the Lord had said. So we see this formula carried through. It's used frequently in the Old Testament. It's used frequently in the gospel accounts of the things that Jesus did and said. It's used in the book of Acts of the things that were done and said by prophets of the New Testament church like Agabus. Exactly. So this formula is something that we find a number of times in the scriptures. One extreme example of it that I want to point out to you is the one involving that unnamed prophet who has come up in presentations several different times here. I've heard him mentioned in 1 Kings chapter 13. The one who went to Bethel to proclaim the destruction of the altar at Bethel and the desecration of it by a king named Josiah. He names the king who eventually will destroy utterly the altar at Bethel that Jeroboam has erected. 1 Kings 13, 1 through 3, has the account of the pronouncement that occurred there. We go to 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 15 through 18, and we have Josiah on the scene destroying the altar, burning the bones of the priests who had served there, saying to the people around him, now whose tomb is that one? And they say to Josiah, that's the tomb of the prophet who predicted that you would do this. And Josiah said, well, leave that tomb alone. And they left that tomb alone. But we have in this instance, in 1 Kings 13, 1 through 3, the setup. We have the word. And then in 2 Kings 23, 15 through 18, we have the event. The word plus the event equals fulfillment. And the fulfillment is stated in that case. And one of the reasons I bring this up is because we have 300 years. According to the text, we have 300 years between the word and the fulfillment. And the people remembered what had been said. They remembered the incidents associated with it. But 300 years between the word and the fulfillment, the event that equaled the fulfillment. I want you to bear that in mind because, as we're hopefully going to see, I said something about how the writers of the Bible were not afraid of prophecy. They didn't have any qualms about making and passing along prophetic predictions that had not yet been fulfilled, and we're going to see how that plays out in the New Testament in particular. I'd like to go to Matthew chapter 11, verses 20 through 23. Jesus, he is the one who really fulfilled that passage in Deuteronomy 18. There were others who fulfilled it in some measure, but the Jews understood, and this is clear not only from the New Testament scriptures, but it's also clear from documents at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, that the Jews understood that when Moses said, when Moses recorded the words of God, I will raise up a prophet from among the people, that he wasn't just saying there will be prophets available. He was saying there would be a specific prophet that you could indicate with capital T-H-E, the prophet, capital P, that there would be a specific prophet that would fulfill that everybody was supposed to listen to. Peter plays on that belief. He uses that belief in his speech in the third chapter of Acts when he is on his way to the temple there and heals the lame man at the temple gate. He makes reference to that idea. Jesus, the prophet, Jesus made predictions. This is a very important part of how Jesus is presented to us in the New Testament. Matthew 11, 20 through 23. Jesus began to denounce the cities in which most of his miracles had been performed because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! If the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it will be more bearable for Tyre and Sidon on the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be lifted up to the skies? No, you will go down to the depths. If the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Sodom, it would have remained to this day. Now, he mentions some cities here that are already gone. What are the ones he mentions that are already gone?
Sodom.
Sodom? Tyre? Okay. He mentions these places that have been obvious examples as targets of the judgment of God, right? The prophets spoke out against them, destruction came upon them. He also mentions some cities that are contemporary with him, and what are they? What are they? Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. He mentions those three specifically, cities in which many of his miracles, much of his teaching had taken place. And he doesn't have anything good to say about them. So Jesus made a prophecy which many, many people have understood as a prophecy of destruction against these cities. Did this prophecy come true? Were these cities destroyed? Well, one of those cities I had a little bit of trouble with because I didn't know too much about the city in the modern realm. I thought I remembered reading something about it, and it took me quite a while to find the source I had originally read it in. It wasn't this one. It was not Unger's Bible Dictionary. But this one said, Chorazin, this city in the general vicinity of Bethsaida and Capernaum near the Sea of Galilee, was upbraided by Jesus and committed to destruction for its unbelief in the face of his mighty works. It's now identified with Chorazah, or Chorazah, or how would you pronounce that, Rick? About 3 miles north of Tel Hum, Capernaum. And then we have some discussion of the excavation that was done there, and the fact that since 1983, coming down into the text here, since 1983, restoration work on the synagogue has been conducted, and some description of the synagogue that was there at Chorazin. Well, I read that, and while I thought I knew what it meant, I wasn't sure I knew what it meant. So is there a city at Chorazin? Is modern Chorazah, is that a city or not? Well, I thought I knew what it meant, but like I said, I wanted to be sure what it meant. So another resource, Compton's Online Encyclopedia. Chorazin, ancient town in Palestine denounced by Jesus, believed to have been located on the site of ruins now called, see, it's Kirbet Chorazah. It's the ruins called Chorazah. 2 miles north of Lake Tiberias, ancient synagogue ruin. And then I finally found the resource I was looking for all along and had a picture of the partially restored synagogue there. Chorazin is nothing but a heap of ruins. Jesus said that these cities would go down to the depths. Chorazin is nothing but a heap of ruins. We go to the next city that Jesus mentioned, Bethsaida, which is a very interesting story in and of itself. This is from the Jerusalem Post. It was here at Bethsaida that three of Jesus' disciples were born, and where some of the major miracles of the New Testament are said to have occurred, such as the feeding of the multitudes and the healing of a blind man. And it was from Bethsaida's shores that Jesus was seen walking on the Sea of Galilee. Well, that's not exactly right about it being from the shores, but we get the idea that they're talking about. Now, after 11 years of excavations under the direction of Dr. Rami Arav on behalf of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, the experts appear to have little doubt that this was the place, despite the fact that Bethsaida was described as a fishing port on Lake Kinneret and the tell is 2 kilometers from the sea. It was hard to identify Bethsaida because the ruins of Bethsaida, which are nothing but ruins, are 2 kilometers from the Sea of Galilee. And clearly in the New Testament, Bethsaida is on the Sea of Galilee. But something happened. Apparently, the experts say, a massive earthquake in the 2nd century caused a landslide which not only covered the town but also moved the shoreline. Bethsaida was abandoned and forgotten. In the 2nd century, Bethsaida fell into ruin because of an earthquake that not only devastated the town but moved the Sea of Galilee 2 kilometers away. The shoreline changed positions, changed outline. Now, this place was in the hands of the Syrians for a long time, and that's one of the reasons why it wasn't recognized, excavated and recognized until very recently, when Israel has been in control of this portion of the Galilee. But Bethsaida today is known, and it is nothing but a heap of ruins, and has been ever since the second century. Jesus said it would go down to the depths. And you, Capernaum, and I don't have too much that I'm going to say about Capernaum, because at least some of you sat in on the Egypt and Israel slideshow, and we looked at a number of slides of Capernaum. Capernaum is also a heap of ruins. It has been excavated. A small area of it has been excavated. There's been a little bit of restoration work on the synagogue, but Capernaum also is a heap of ruins. Now, it's an astonishing thing, or at least, well, I believe it is an astonishing thing, that Jesus could say this about a city like Capernaum, because Capernaum was a flourishing, up-and-coming, prosperous city in the days of Jesus. It was ideally situated. It was in exactly the right place for a city to endure and have a long history ahead of it. It was at a place where the most important road of Roman trade passed through, the road that connected Egypt with Asia and Europe. It was in a tremendously valuable place. It was a center of tax collection, a center of the fishing industry. It was ideally located. It was a very prosperous, thriving community. Now, Jesus made predictions about three towns here: Capernaum, Chorazin, and Bethsaida. Jesus passed through a lot of towns that we have named in the New Testament, and some of those towns have died, and some of those towns have continued on. Nazareth continued on. Bethany continued on. We could go down the list and talk about places Jesus visited, the ones that survived and the ones that didn't. But it's very compelling to me that Jesus is specifically recorded as mentioning three towns and saying that they will go down to the depths, that they will be subject to judgment, and he compares them to places like Tyre, Sidon, Sodom, and Gomorrah. Tyre and Sidon and Sodom, okay? And all three of those places became nothing but a heap of ruins. Now, the apostles, those eyewitnesses who wrote down Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were not afraid to include this kind of information. Why weren't they afraid to include this kind of information? It's clear because Capernaum survives into the 5th century, at least in a small way. There is a church building in use at Capernaum in the 5th century. It didn't happen overnight that these places disappeared. It wasn't in the second century they disappeared. Capernaum lingered on for quite a while before it was completely gone. So why do we have in the scriptures a statement by Jesus that would clearly be understood by almost everyone who reads it as a pronouncement of doom, not only a matter of individual judgment of people who had rejected him, but these cities would come to nothing because of the way that they had received him? Why would the New Testament authors keep an account like that when clearly at the time when they were written down it had not taken place? Well, it's because they believed they were reporting the words of a prophet of God. And so others would believe. And yet, they were not able to use the prophetic formula here, were they? They couldn't say, "And so it came to be," because it hadn't come to be by the time these things were written down. We have another example that I want to share with you or remind you of, which is, I'm sure, no surprise, and that's Luke 13, 34 and 35 regarding Jerusalem. Jesus says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Jesus spoke out against Jerusalem. He wasn't happy about this pronouncement. He wasn't happy about the one he made regarding Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. This was a pronouncement of grief more than anything else. He wasn't happy about this. He does not like to bring judgment or condemnation. He speaks out against Jerusalem here, and he says, "I wanted a different outcome. I wanted something else. But because of the way you have behaved consistently," including the way they behaved in receiving him, he says, "your house is left to you desolate." That's an interesting expression. Your house is left to you desolate. I would suggest that he is not speaking here of total destruction, that is to say, of the end of occupation of that location. Your house is left to you, okay? There will still be a house, but it will be a desolate house, Jesus says. Jesus made another statement in connection with Jerusalem in Matthew chapter 24, verses 1 and 2. Jesus left the temple and was walking away with his, when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. "Do you see all these things?" he asked. "I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." Again, if you were here for any of the slideshow on the second day that I did that, one of the things that I emphasized was a street of First City Jerusalem and the stones that had been cast down from the Temple Mount above. Jesus said, not one stone here will be left on another. And indeed, the Temple Mount was brought down to ground level. Everything above ground level was pushed to the pavement down below, all the way around. This picture, if you can remember, those of you who saw it, the archway that went up to the Temple Mount, here are those stones that supported the archway that would have had shops in them one time. This picture is a little earlier than the time when we visited there last year. But we have these massive stones that have been pushed down from the walls of the temple courtyard up above. Jesus said, not one stone will be left upon another. Now, was Jesus right that Jerusalem's house was left to her desolate? Well, I would say he certainly was. When did Jesus make that prediction according to the gospel accounts? About 30. I would say 30 is probably exactly when it was, but we'll say about 30 and say plus or minus a year. Jesus made that prediction about 30. When did this come about, that not one stone was left upon another? 70. What's the time frame from 30 to 70? 40 years. That's a good biblical number. It's one of the reasons that I have high confidence in the 30 being the right. There are other external reasons, external to the Bible, about timekeeping and so forth, but it's one of the reasons I have a pretty high level of confidence that 30 is the right year for Jesus to have died, because he made that prediction very shortly. It's the last week. Very shortly before he went to the cross, he made that prediction. And 40 is a good biblical number because it corresponds to the period of time that it took before the Lord was able to roll away the reproach of Egypt from the Israelites when they came out. And it corresponds to several other things in biblical sense as well, and that's part of the connectivity and continuity that we see in the Scriptures. Yes, Vesper?
That's called
types. Types, yes it is. That's types, and I said the other day it would be good to just spend quite a lot of time looking at types as an indication of the reliability of Scripture, because they are borne out again and again in the consistency of the Scriptures. I heard the idea of the prophetic formula for the first time from a man who I could not reasonably describe as a Christian. He is a man who respects the Bible tremendously. And he pointed out the fact that the prophetic formula is important in looking at the prophecy that Jesus made about Jerusalem. He also pointed out that it was 40 years from the time that Jesus made the prophecy until the prophecy was fulfilled. And then he said, I don't think that's significant, but it was 40 years. Well, I do think it was significant. I think that God is consistent in the way that he works. I believe that that was intentional on the part of God. He allowed a generation to pass while the Jews of Jerusalem, specifically the Jews of Jerusalem, came to terms with the fact that the Messiah had been among them, had walked their streets, had performed miracles in their temple courts, and had taught them the way of the Lord, and had urged them to reform and repent. He allowed that generation in perfect consistency with what he had done other times in dealing with his people Israel. But when we think about the prophetic formula, yes, Vesper? Okay, Matthew 21:43, Jesus looked ahead and told what would take place in the transition from the old to the new. Jesus is presented to us as saying that Jerusalem would be destroyed. I have suggested to you from numerous other kinds of evidence that the gospel accounts were written by eyewitnesses, and there are a lot of other kinds of evidence we could spend time looking at, but we have looked at a few, that the gospel accounts were written by eyewitnesses, people who were close at hand, Luke not being an eyewitness, but interviewing eyewitnesses about not one stone here being left on another. When were those prophecies made? More than that, when were those prophecies written down? You see, if we remember the prophetic formula, this has bearing on the credibility of those prophecies. Because I have tried to point out that in both Old and New Testaments, we have numerous consistent examples that when a prophet made a statement, and that statement was fulfilled, then we're told that that statement was fulfilled. Where in Matthew do I find the teaching that what Jesus said about Jerusalem and the temple was fulfilled? Where do I find it in Mark? Where do I find it in Luke? Why don't I find that there? Because it hadn't happened yet. And the indication is very clear, because they do handle the words of Jesus this way, as the words of Jeremiah are handled, as the words of other Old Testament prophets are handled. They do handle the words of Jesus this way, that when Jesus said something and it happened, they say, and it happened. Because that's the credibility of a prophet. But they didn't say that. None of those writers said that, because all of those writers wrote it down before it happened. They wrote it down before it happened. If they had written it down after it happened, they would have, the likelihood of them ignoring that, not saying, and it happened, is infinitesimally small. It would be completely inconsistent with the way they write about him elsewhere and the way prophecy is handled in the scriptures. They did not say it happened because when they wrote it down, it hadn't happened yet. And we have external testimony as to the fact that this prophecy was made before the destruction of Jerusalem. That guy Josephus again? Josephus is one of the sources, and several second century Christian writers make reference to this sort of thing as well. But Josephus is one of the sources that tells us that the Christians did not stay and fight in Jerusalem. Why not? Well, because Jesus told them don't. Jesus said, when you see these things coming about, head for the hills. And they did. They did head for the hills. The Essenes didn't head for the hills. Those people that lived at Qumran, they joined the battle to the last man. The Zealots did not head for the hills, unless you count Masada as a hill. And they died to the last man. They fought to the bitter end, and they died. The Pharisees and Sadducees, the Sadducees were pretty well exterminated in this deal. And the Pharisees that survived in other communities carried on Pharisaic tradition, and it developed into rabbinic Judaism for the most part. But those people who did not accept the statement of Jesus basically went along with the program and died in that conflagration, in the destruction of Jerusalem and the overthrow of the temple. There is no question that this prophecy was made before the overthrow of Jerusalem, that Jesus made this prophecy, and it was recorded by the eyewitnesses before it took place. Now, once again, why would they put that in there about Capernaum, Chorazin, and Bethsaida? Obviously before it happened. Why would they put that in about Jerusalem? Clearly before it happened, because of the way that they handle these statements. It's clear that they wrote it down before it happened. Why would they do that? Well, it's because they believed that Jesus was a true prophet of God, and what he said would be fulfilled. They didn't know how long it would take. When that prophecy that was made by the prophet who spoke out against the altar at Bethel in the days of Jeroboam, when that prophecy was made and recorded, they didn't know how long that was going to take, when that son of David named Josiah would be on the scene. It was 300 years later. But the prophecy was retained and fulfilled. And in keeping with prophetic formula, we were told this is what that prophet was talking about. Well, the New Testament came to a close. Particularly the Gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were closed before the destruction of Jerusalem. And so we don't have, and so it came about as Jesus had said, that the word of the Lord was fulfilled. We see that it was fulfilled by looking at the history of the matter. Yes, Vesper?
How long will it be going on?
Someone else may have to answer that for you right now. I don't really have a clear focus on what Daniel 9:27 is, so I'm... With my current kind of focus that I have, without spending a little bit of time looking back and paying attention to that context, I'm really not prepared to give an answer to that at the moment. Okay. Does not even include this prophecy at all. That's right. Duane says it's interesting that the Gospel of John, which seems to have been written later, does not include this prophecy, because there was already testimony to the prophecy. And John, writing about it after the fact, didn't feel the need to include it and then to say, there, you see, it happened just like that, because it's already out there for people to know about and for people to read and for people to rely upon in the previous accounts that were written by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So let's remember the prophetic formula. It is one of a multitude of evidences for the authenticity of the biblical text, that it was written in the time in which it is presented as being written, that it is written by the people who are presented as being responsible for it, and that it is an accurate picture of the world that they are writing about, both of the historic events that have already taken place and of the historic events that are yet to take place, the prophetic events that we're looking forward to. You may remember this slide. It's a picture of a spiral galaxy taken by the Hubble telescope, and you can probably leave the lights off for the remainder here of the few things that we're going to look at in a quick review. I made the assertion, and I certainly believe this, that science is in no way in conflict with the Scriptures. The facts of science do not conflict with the facts of Scripture. Sometimes we have problems with interpretations. We had the idea presented to us by the eminent astronomer Robert Jastrow that the universe had a beginning, which was a very troublesome concept to the astronomers and the physicists, because it meant that they were going to have to come to terms with some things that they didn't want to come to terms with. If the universe has a beginning, there has to be some sort of a cause for that. If the universe has an end, we have to come to terms with the temporal nature of the universe. It is not eternal. What is? And our answer to that, of course, is God. Jastrow made this statement that when the astronomers climbed their way to the top of the hill and looked over the top, there were the theologians sitting there already, and the astronomers didn't like that very much. But that's the way it is. The Bible all along has said that the universe has a beginning and will have an end. The laws of thermodynamics, the life story of stars, and the expansion of the universe were three things that Jastrow mentioned that all attest to these kinds of ideas. We also in here, back on day one, talked about some of the textual evidence for the Scriptures. We talked about the Greek Bible. We talked about some of the papyri, the papyrus manuscripts, including this little fragment from the Gospel of John, which dates back to about 125 of our era, was found down in Egypt and says to us that within a generation of the time when John died, his writings were in use as scriptures and were widely scattered over the Roman world. And so we can put our confidence in the antiquity of the text of the Greek New Testament. We also talked, particularly on day two, about the Hebrew Bible. We have the Masoretic text, which is about 1,000 years old. We had no way of looking back beyond that 1,000 years to see whether the time span before that had been handled with the tremendous care necessary to transmit the Scriptures accurately, until in 1947, when the first of the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, including this Isaiah scroll, which dates to about 150 BC. And we found from that, in looking at the textual evidence of both the Greek Bible and the Hebrew Bible, that we can count on the accuracy of our biblical text to a level of about 99.9%, that there is less than 1/1,000th of the text that is in question as to just exactly what the Bible says. And I emphasized one of those texts with you yesterday and won't go back into that. Text that is really not very significant in terms of understanding about God or understanding about our responsibilities before God, that there are no doctrinal questions left open by any of that tiny fraction of the text where we're not exactly sure what the original copy said, because there have been some problems in the transmission over the centuries. Through several millennia, through several thousand years, the Scriptures have been accurately transmitted. We can know with confidence what God is saying to us. We also looked at a small artifact called a silver scroll, or at least I call it a silver scroll, which came from a tomb in Jerusalem. Dates back to the 7th century BC, to the days of Jeremiah, close to the time of Josiah. And that had a passage from the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 and following, the priestly blessing, attesting to us, confirming to us that the law was in use, that the law was known in the days of Jeremiah. We have other evidence to that effect, but this was a very exciting discovery made in Jerusalem in 1979, confirming that fact. We talked about seals and bulla, just small little inscriptional evidence that attests to us that we have real people described to us in the Bible, accurately presented. Does anyone remember what that particular bulla said on it? Belonging to who? Baruch, son of Neriah, the scribe. The man who wrote down the book of Jeremiah at the dictation of Jeremiah, all right, and was probably responsible for the gathering of the books of the Bible and their transmission to the people in the Babylonian captivity. That part's a little bit speculative, but God clearly had a special purpose in mind for this man. And we have this personal touch of effectively having his signature in hand, this man who was so important in the story of Jeremiah, as a witness to him and making sure that what he wrote survived, or what he relayed from God survived. We also talked a little bit about archaeology. We didn't touch on very much there, but we talked a little bit about archaeology, how, for example, finding the ancient city of Nineveh overturned the objections of the critics who were saying that the biblical account of Nineveh was just a lot of mythology and nothing there that you could rely on. It was exactly the kind of city that is described in the Bible. And in the excavations there and looking at the palace walls of Sennacherib, we find that there are a number of correspondences between the records of the Assyrians and the events that are recorded for us in the Bible, that biblical personages, kings, are mentioned in those same chronicles. And again, the Bible was borne out as being an accurate depiction of the times in which it was written, the times it was written about. We talked about idols, particularly this little stand, which is only knee-high but has so much on it that reflects on biblical imagery, both good and bad biblical imagery, reminding us of Jehovah who is enthroned between the cherubim, but also reminding us that as described in the Bible, the people were confusing the worship of Jehovah with the worship of the sun, and they were confusing the nature of Jehovah by supposing that he had a heavenly mistress, that he had a consort in heaven, and God wanted to thwart that kind of teaching, and so he told them that they were his bride, they were his wife, and that he wanted none other. And so the idols themselves speak to the accuracy with which the text of the scriptures have been transmitted to us. We talked just a little bit yesterday about human origins and the fact that we find different faces on ancient man, contemporaneous, living together at the same time, as in the scriptures, where we have the Nephilim, we have the sons of Anak, the children of Anak, the Anakites, we have the Rephaites, we have these different people who were bigger and stronger than the average human being, but were still human beings. And we find the same thing in the record that is presented by archaeology, anthropology, paleontology, that there is no conflict between the information we find on the one hand and the information that is presented on the other hand, the Bible and nature. We also had a brief glimpse today at prophecy, and a reminder of that is the ruins of Capernaum here. Jesus made certain prophecies, and the prophecies that Jesus made came true. He said Capernaum would be brought down to the depths, and Capernaum was brought down to the depths. He had three cities that he specifically singled out, and all three of them became nothing but ruins, and very dramatically so. Also, the city of Jerusalem that he talked about, and exactly what he said about Jerusalem, came to be the case. Her house was left to her desolate. The Jews today, many of them would certainly love to take possession once again of the Temple Mount and have a house there again, but their house is left to them desolate. What Jesus says was certainly fulfilled, and I want to remind you in closing that Jesus has made another prophecy. Jesus, the true prophet of God, has said, "I will come again." And just as certainly as what he said about Capernaum came true, what he said about Bethsaida came true, what he said about Chorazin came true, what he said about Jerusalem and the temple came true, this one will come true. Jesus will come again. The Bible, God's incredible book, is not simply a book about past things, about old things, that we can rely on an accurate historical record here. It is a book about the here and now and the days that lie ahead, a book about our future. A book that we need to pay tremendous attention to, and indeed a book that we need to build our lives around. A true and accurate picture of God. I will say, as others have said, thank you very much to the brethren at Anaheim and the surrounding congregations who have been such generous hosts and have worked so hard to make this work, and thanks also to all of you who traveled a long ways to come and share in these things with us. I hope that we've all been blessed by the time we've had here in these last 2 weeks.